Welcome to an enlightening podcast from IslamPodcasts.com. We encourage our listeners to please comment and let us know how we can grow in our knowledge to better serve our community. Please remind your family and friends to also visit IslamPodcasts.com for engaging discussions on current events, Islamic guidance, Quran, tafsir, seerah, and much more. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Podcasts on current events, Islamic guidance, Quran tafsir, and seerah are available at islampodcasts.com as well as on iTunes. Rate, review, and comment and let us know how we can grow in our knowledge to better serve our community. Please subscribe, share, and tell a friend about islampodcasts.com as well as rate, review of iTunes.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. All praise due to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We praise Him, we seek His forgiveness, we ask for His mercy, and we send peace and blessings upon the Prophet Muhammad and indeed all the prophets of God and to those who follow their guidance until the end. As I was walking to the university, it struck me just how much the university has changed over time. I did my undergraduate degree at Sydney Uni, graduated from the U about 8 or 9 years ago now, and it's changed a lot in that time. And as I was walking here from Central, from UTS, I was thinking about that this was really the first time that I had got involved within the Muslim community. It was through my interaction through IAW and other events at Sydney Uni. And it was actually one of the profound moments I had during my IAW experience was when I spoke to a non-Muslim woman. She was an arts student, and she asked me a question which was actually relevant to our topic today. She said, "I'm a good person. I feed the hungry, I clothe the poor, I fight for social justice, I'm good to my parents. I do all sorts of good things, but I reject the notion of God. What does Islam say about me? And what do you say about me? According to you, am I indeed a good person or am I just in control of things?" And when she asked that question, I was, 18-year-old guy from Southwest Sydney, and it actually shook me for a moment. I went, for me, time stood still for about what felt like 5 minutes. It was actually about 2.5 seconds. And I was actually thinking, what is the answer to this question? So it's an excellent question. And many people are actually in that scenario where you would define the characteristics as good people, but they don't believe in God, or they don't believe in the deity, or anything else for that matter. What does Islam say about these people? Or about this concept in general? And I get an answer, which hopefully by the end of the lesson, I'll give you that answer. If I forget, please remind me. So I'm not one to spoil the needs. So we'll give you that answer at the end of this session, God willing. So the question today is, can you be good without God? And I think it's a purposefully vague question, and it has a very, very important implication. But before we can answer that question, and drawing on my project background, it's very important for us first to define the question and understand the question properly. And the biggest source of ambiguity in the question is, what does it mean to be good? Before you can say, can you be good without God? Yes, the answer is yes. You can't do that until you understand, what does it mean to be good? So if we were to define good, which is no easy task, mind you, because good is actually a value. It's a value. So what I deem to be good may be completely different to what you deem to be good. And it's affected by our cultural background, our religious background, our hobbies and interests, our socioeconomic backgrounds. All of these things affect our understanding of what it means to be good. So it's important for us, first of all, to come up with a definition of what it means to be good. And if we were to ask people, if I was running a project, I would probably put together a focus group, and start brainstorming. All right, guys, what does it mean to be good? Give me some examples of good behavior. And I'm not one to pick out a dictionary and read to you, you know, if it means moral excellence and to achieve excellence in every aspect and so forth. But, you know, to hold a focus group and determine what it means to be good, you would come up with it with a myriad of different definitions. Among the definitions you would receive, you know, someone might say, well, it means to be good to your neighbors. And I think we'd all agree that part of being good will incorporate your treatment of your neighbors and treating your neighbors well. But obviously the definition is wider than that, because then what about your parents? What about family, siblings, friends, and so forth, which aren't included under that one definition of just neighbors? So obviously the definition would have to also include family. But again, you can't limit it there, because there are many people who don't fall into either category, neighbors and family. So you'd have to broaden the definition even more. So you might say, well, you know, fighting for social justice. Now that sounds, you know, there's some buzzwords right there. That sounds good. Let's include that in the definition as well. So being dutiful to your neighbors, to your family, and fighting for social justice. Again, we're missing some very basic definitions and basic elements of the definition. What about the spilling of blood, the taking of life? So obviously there has to be some sort of acknowledgement about the sanctity of human life as part of our definition. We will need to include that somewhere in our definition. And these are things which I'm sure we can all agree on as a society. Whether you're Muslim, whether you're non-Muslim, whether you're Jewish, or whether you're agnostic, it doesn't matter what nationality you are, or what cultural background, or what religion you belong to. I think everything I'm saying so far, these points, we can all agree with these definitions. You know, some might say, well, let's also include looking after and caring for the needy as part of that definition. Because again, if you thought of someone who looks after the poor and dedicates their time and so forth, again, you would agree this person is a good person. If we look at just that element, just that aspect of their life, you would think this person is a good person. So again, that's a fundamental part of the definition that, you know, I'd like to use moving forward. But again, it's not limited to that. What about theft? You know, if we were to think about a person who steals or is notorious for theft, would you consider that person to be good? I think we'd all agree that no, we don't. That person is not a good person. That element of itself, looking at that element in and of itself, would deem that person to be you know, a bad person or a person devoid of moral conduct and ethics. So again, that's, you know, another thing to consider. Again, look at lying. The trait that is lying. And the fact that everyone would rush to move away from someone who was a notorious liar. Someone who was always lying. First, you wouldn't trust their word, you wouldn't want to keep their company. And, you know, we all know the story of, you know, the boy who cried wolf, for example. So this person, people would flee from them. Because, again, it's a characteristic that seemed to be, you know, devoid of a moral person. Does dress code come into it? You know, do we incorporate dress code into a definition of goodness? Or is it sufficient to say, no, it's okay, we're happy with our definition? Does dress code play into it at all? You know, if you had someone, a humanitarian, who, for example, you know, if I was to come in wearing a scarf made of, you know, like a fur coat, for example, or something like that, I'm sure that some people would object to it. That if it's made from pure fur skin, for example, some would object to it and say, well, that's cruelty to animals. How can you consider yourself to be a good person when you're cruel to animals? That's a creation of God. How can you consider yourself to be good? So some may also include dress code, and many Muslims, I'm sure, would also include dress code as part of moral conduct. What about dietary requirements? Is there a dietary element to the definition as well? So a person, is a person more accountable for what they eat? Do we incorporate that into our definition of what it means to be a good person or not? Again, if we look at, you know, for example, vegetarians or vegans, for example, and how they would respond to the slaughtering of you know, animals for our meat consumption. Again, you know, some would object that this person is a good person based on that characteristic. And again, we're generalizing a bit here, but if we looked at only that characteristic and nothing else. So these are all things which a person may have as part of their own definitions. And you can see that obviously the definition is affected by your religion, it's affected by your culture, it's affected by your hobbies, it's affected by your core beliefs. So it could vary from person to person. I think we'd all share some basic principles and basic elements of the definition of what it means to be good, such as, you know, human life, respecting human life, such as being good to neighbours and family and so on and so forth, and social justice and equality and fairness and you know, all these buzzwords. But then it differs on what we call the branches. The branches. And these are heavily swayed by your backgrounds and so forth. So, and again, you know, do we look at, you know, the general concept of respect, would definitely be part of the definition. Some would also include our treatment of the environment, our treatment of trees, animals, and so on and so forth. So, you know, there's room to expand a definition. The problem with it, though, is if I was a new migrant to Australia and I said, okay, define and explain to me what it means to be good. And you were to say, well, it means to be good to your parents, to be good to your neighbours, to do this and to do that. It's very difficult to actually hone in on one definition of what it means to be good. Islam has an answer to that. In Islam, God has given us an answer of what it means to be good. And it's a very simple definition. The definition itself is actually very simple. The definition in Islam of what it means to be good is to avoid the prohibitions of God and to perform the commands of God to the best of one's ability. So to avoid the prohibitions of God and to perform the commands of God to the best of one's ability. The reason that there's a stipulation of to the best of one's ability is that sometimes you're not able to do a certain action. You can't do the entire action, so you do of it what you're able to do. So this is the definition. Now, how can I summarize everything I spoke about earlier from equality and social justice and feeding the poor and not lying and avoiding stealing and avoiding these things into four or five or six words, which is Islam's definition? The reason is all of the attributes I mentioned earlier are included under the commands of God or under the prohibitions of God. So they're all lesser included commands under the greater commandment, which is to obey God. So if we were to go back through the list that we mentioned earlier, and we analyze it through an Islamic lens, in terms of the treatment of neighbours, the Prophet, peace be upon him, in a prophetic tradition, he mentioned to us that he is not a true believer, the one who harms his neighbour, or the one whose neighbour is not safe from his harm. So a believer, or someone who claims to be a believer, who harms his neighbour, is not considered to be a true believer. And in many other prophetic traditions, he mentioned to us the importance of treating our neighbours with respect. And there's many narrations that we could actually mention on this point. With regards to the treatment of family. Again, the Prophet mentioned, the best amongst you are those who are best to their families. And I am the best amongst you towards his family. So we see that the treatment of family is included within that command. He also mentioned many different narrations about social justice. He said he is not a true believer, the one who is not concerned with the affairs of the nation. So if there are people that are going through hardship, that are going through calamities and turmoil and so forth, a true believer is someone who's concerned with what's going on around the world. Whether it's happening in Syria, whether it's happening in Africa, whether it's happening in Somalia, or happening in Burma, or wherever it may be, a true believer is someone who's concerned with the plight of the world in general. So this is someone, these are again attributes mentioned by the Prophet Muhammad. The sanctity of human life, again, is mentioned by God and by the Prophet Muhammad. God mentions in the Quran, which is Islam's equivalent to the Bible, God mentions that if you take an innocent life, if you take one life, and this refers to taking a life without just cause, if you take one life, it's as though you've killed all of mankind. And if you were to save one life, it's as though you've saved the life of all mankind. So the sanctity of human life does play a role here as well. If you look, in terms of the looking after the poor and needy, there are ample narrations and prophetic traditions that talk about our treatment of the poor and needy. It's mentioned in the Quran time and time and time again, and mentioned through many, many, many prophetic examples, which are, quite frankly, too many to list. It's very, very common. There's not a single person who wouldn't tell you that it's essential to Islam to look after the poor and needy. There are many, many, many examples about theft. There are many examples about lying. In fact, the Prophet said that a believer does not lie. So, you know, and this came about, this saying came about because a companion said to him, O Prophet of God, is it possible that a believer may commit a certain sin? So the prophet said, yes. So the believer wanted, this man wanted to test just what kind of sins a believer could fall into. He said, can a believer fall into, you know, into fornication? He said, yes. A believer may, in a moment of weakness, fall into fornication. But then obviously he's required to repent and turn back. He said, does a believer lie? The prophet said, the believer does not lie. Because this affects your own moral conduct. And affects people's perception of you as an individual. So that there are prophetic traditions that talk about the sin of lying. There are also dietary requirements that are mentioned as part of the prophetic commands. In terms of dietary requirements, some of these requirements talk about how we actually slaughter food. Now, when you hear the concept halal food, you know, halal meat, halal this, halal that, you know, you can't go to a restaurant these days without saying, oh, you know, we serve halal meat and we serve halal chicken and so on and so forth. I actually saw a place that we serve halal pork. The concept of halal is one of those things that it's in at the moment. Halal actually, if you go to the very core of the definition of halal, it refers to humane slaughtering of animals. Slaughtering an animal in the most humane way possible, so that you lessen the suffering. So for example, that you're going to eat, but that we minimize the suffering of the animal before it's slaughtered, before its life is taken, to minimize any suffering it goes through. And in fact, there was one of the companions of the Prophet of God, he wrestled his goat to the ground. And once he secured on the ground, he stood up and he put his foot on the neck of the goat. Then he grabbed his knives and started sharpening his knives. Alright? All of this was happening in front of the goat, and the goat was terrified. And the Prophet happened to be walking by at that moment. And so he said, what are you doing? Are you trying to kill the goat twice? You're going to kill it out of its fright, and it's absolutely terrified. You're going to kill it from fright and terror, and then you're going to actually slaughter it. So why are you putting it through all this hardship and burden? That's not humane. Do not do that. And then he explained the way it's meant to be done is that you prepare yourself beforehand, you sharpen your knives and prepare everything beforehand, and then you take that you want to secure the animal, but you slaughter it in the most humane way possible by cutting a certain vein, which the jugular, which causes it to bleed out immediately, when it actually numbs the animal and causes it to for its soul to leave very, very quickly and efficiently, which reduces the suffering the animal goes through, as opposed to other methods of slaughter. So this was actually mentioned by the Prophet. And in another narration, he mentions that God has commanded you to perform excellence in everything you do. So to do everything to the best of your ability. And he spoke specifically about slaughtering animals. So if you'll take to slaughter an animal, slaughter it to the best of your ability. So this is mentioned explicitly by the Prophet of God. There are also, in fact, when the Prophet first started to convey his message, he was called a madman by some of the enemies of the Prophet. One of the proofs they had against him, one of the reasons they called him a madman, was because he gave animals rights. One of the reasons was because he gave animals rights. So when he commanded people to not overload the camels, and so they were his tribesmen previously, and so they thought, all right, we draw the line at animals. You know, you want to give women rights? Even that's far-fetched to us. But fine, we'll go with you on that point. You know, even if we were to agree with you, which we don't, but even if we agree with you on that point, you want to give animals rights as well? What's wrong with you? You know, you must be insane. You know, so treating animals humanely as well is included within Islam's definition of what it means to be good. In terms of respect, again, these are basic human rights. And the Prophet spoke about this as well, whether you're old or young. He said, he is not from us. He's not a believer. The one who doesn't show respect to the elders and mercy to the youngins. So these are all etiquettes that are mentioned within the Islamic tradition. And there are also many traditions that talk about the earth, that talk about trees, that talk about one another and mankind and so on and so forth. So all of these are included within the definition of to avoid the prohibitions of God and to perform the commandments of God to the best of one's ability. Now, our own definition of goodness is purely subjective. That means that over time, it's likely to change. What I consider to be good now may not necessarily be the same as what I consider to be good in 10 years from now? So right now, I have a certain set of core beliefs and values. In 10 years' time, as my life experience grows and forms and so forth, I will likely change what my perception of good is. So this is likely to change. And we can see traces of this in Australian society. So if we were to go wind the clock back 100 or so years, and we actually don't need to go back that far, but let's go back 100 years for argument's sake. And let's look at Australia's treatment, as a government, Australia's treatment of women in society. Women weren't allowed to vote. Women were seen as the inferior of the two sexes. Women were allowed to work, but if they did work, and I mean even that was scarce, but if they were able to work, if they were pioneers and actually did get a job and did work, that the levels of pay were nowhere near commensurate with their expertise or with their male counterparts. So what they would get paid was, you know, what we'd say nowadays is peanuts. You know, they would get paid really menial amounts. They didn't have the right to vote. They didn't have any say or very little say within the family structure. So women, Australia, so this was instituted by the government. This wasn't, this wasn't a few individuals. This was the Australian government's view of women in general. And if we look at going back 40 or 50 years or so, and we look at Australia's treatment of the Indigenous race, how Australia treated the Aborigines. The Aborigines didn't actually have any claim to land ownership or land title until when? You know, some say, 1967. In actuality, it wasn't until 1991. Until which decision was it? It was the Mabo case. It wasn't until then that it was recognised that Aboriginals actually had land title ownership. Because before that, Australia, the Aborigines were seen as an uncivilised nation. That, you know, the British came and they basically took over, or they claimed the land that wasn't actually inhabited by a civilisation. So if you look at the Australian government's treatment of the Aboriginal race, again, we'll see that there were things in that which were seen as good at the time. I mean, if we look at the Stolen Generation, for example. The Stolen Generation. What was that? That was effectively, we know how to raise your kids better than you can. Because you're Aboriginal, you don't know how to raise your kids. So we're going to strip you of your children, and we're going to raise them on your behalf. We're going to raise them instead. We're going to cut them off from you completely, and we're going to raise your kids because we know better how to raise your children. You don't know how to raise children. We do. So we're going to take your children from you and raise them instead. And this was seen as a good thing. This was seen as a good thing. So, and look, for argument's sake, I actually think that whoever decided that, you know, that administration at the time was actually well-intentioned. They actually thought they were doing a good thing. You know, it wasn't like, how can we be cruel and evil to the Indigenous race? It was, you know, there has to be something, we've got to do something to fix issues with, you know, the Aboriginal race. So how about this? Let's take their kids from them. And it was seen as a good thing. 40 or 50 years down the track, how do we view the Stolen Generation? How do we see that, you know, that action itself? How do we view it? I think we'd all agree that, you know, it was, for simplicity purposes, it was bad. It was bad, it was evil. To take anyone's child from them without just cause is nothing short of pure evil. But this was seen as good at the time. Now, 30 or 40 or 50 years down the track, our context changes, environment changes, our values change, and we can acknowledge and we can recognise that actually impact was bad. But at the time, it was seen as good. So society's values are, you know, they're malleable. They shift and change. They're not defined. So they're good at some point, but they're changing in future. And this has happened with, and there are countless examples that come to mind about things that were permissible or were seen as good at the time, which change over time. The Islamic legislation isn't susceptible to this same issue. What God decrees through legislation by His prophets is a law which was applicable then and is applicable now. So whatever was decreed by God through the Prophet Muhammad is still valid in this day and age. So every command that was given to the Prophet that was valid at the time of his death is still valid now, 1400 years later. So, for example, the Prophet, peace be upon him, he ordered us to avoid the consumption of alcohol. He mentioned to us that alcohol has certain dangers and certain perils, and told us to avoid the drinking of alcohol. that command was valid 1,400 years ago, and it's valid in this day and age. So till this day, you won't find a practicing Muslim who will stand up and say that you can drink alcohol. Everyone agrees unanimously that a person cannot drink alcohol within Islam because it's against Islam. There's a Quranic injunction against the consumption of alcohol, or prohibition, I should say, against consumption of alcohol. And that law doesn't change. It was valid then, it's valid now. So whatever God decrees doesn't change. And the reason for that is that God is complete. God is perfect. See, what we've got to understand is that when it comes to our own values and our own laws, we determine our own laws. We put together our own values. So that we think that they're good. Under our own limited understanding, we consider them to be good in the here and now. But as time changes, and the context changes, and the values change, and societies change, that people's perception of what we thought was good is also likely to change. Whereas when it comes to the legislation of God, God is perfect, God is complete, God has knowledge of all things. So when God makes a decision, or when God releases legislation, that legislation is based on certain knowledge, is based on nothing at all which is doubtful. It's absolute, it's complete, it's perfect. And God knows us better than we know ourselves. God knows our context, He knows what's best for us, He knows the society. So He has a broader range and broader horizon, and is able to give us legislation that is complete. And so for that reason, there is no requirement for that understanding to change. There is no reason for that legislation to change. Whereas with our own laws, we often need to change them, with the times. So you'll find that, for example, last week I was doing some reading, and Barry O'Farrell was actually talking about making some changes to the drinking laws in what was called the entertainment districts, such as King's Cross and so forth, that they're changing the drinking laws, such that the drinks are not able to be served within an hour of closing times, and that you can't order any more than four drinks by any one person at any one time, and so on and so forth. So they're actually proposing these new changes, which are coming into effect as a reactionary measure against the individual that was that was killed in the cross. I think through what was it called? Someone walked up to him and basically king hit him, and the guy died on the spot basically. So as a reaction to that incident, they came up with these new laws. I thought, okay, well, the current laws aren't working effectively. We need some reform. We need to change it. So as a response to some social problems, which is revolved around the consumption of alcohol, let's now implement this new law. And it's coming into effect very soon. Another thing that was another change to legislation, when you watch movies, and I'm sure we all watch movies at some point in our lives here, when the police arrest a bad guy, what are they read them their rights. What's the first thing they say? Does anyone know? You have the right to what? The right to remain silent. That's right. What's the next thing they say? Anything you say can be used against you. That's right. So basically what it's saying to you is, you're better off staying quiet. You should stay quiet. And if you choose to speak, it could actually harm you. So you're better off staying silent. Because if you speak, you're opening a door which basically could tell us about your crimes, and it could be used against you in court. So you're best off staying silent. And if you stay silent, there's a presumption of innocence until you're proven guilty. Again, the federal government is looking at implementing changes within the constitution, so that if a person chooses to exercise silence, that this person's silence can actually be used against them. So if you remain silent, that there's it could be used. Also, you have the right to remain silent, but this may harm you, or something to that effect. So they're changing the wording so that if you actually remain silent, it could actually cause for there to be a presumption of guilt on your behalf rather than innocence. So this is another change that was suggested by the federal government. So again, we see that the reason for it, and I work in a justice, I've got a justice background, I do projects for a major department, a government department, which is why I'm aware of these decisions. The reason for this is because there was an outcry by the police. police were saying, you know, we arrest these bad guys, we take them to court, but then what happens? Nothing. We take them to court, they choose to remain silent. We don't say, we try to find out accomplices, we try to find out evidence, and they just remain silent. We have no way at all of knowing anything. Or they keep us in the dark without telling us about alibis or anything else. We build our case, and then they thwart us last minute on the stand by telling us something which, you know, we weren't even across. So now the police have said, well, now you've got to say something. Otherwise, it could actually come and work against you. And so this is a change of legislation. Now, in Islam, what's the Islamic ruling on this issue? If a person is taken to court and they're accused, what's their right in Islam? Not many people actually know the answer to this. In Islam, if a person goes to court, regardless of what the crime was, if he's accused by someone, so let's say there aren't sufficient witnesses to prove the case, and a person wants to accuse them, whether they're accusing them of theft or anything else, if I was to say, I accuse you of stealing my bag, for example. You know, you stole my bag, I'm sure you stole my bag. So the judge will say to me, or the defense attorney will say to me, do you have any proof? Well, no, I don't, but I promise that's my bag. I bought it from, you know, I bought it last year and I haven't got the receipt anymore, but that's my bag. So now I've accused someone of stealing my bag. What happens now? Now the judge will ask, now if I had proof, if I said, well, here's security footage of that person stealing my bag, or here's three guys who witnessed this person steal my bag, that's a different story. It's basically an open and shut case. I'll like you in that case without any problems. But if I didn't have any proof, I've accused someone of stealing my bag. The judge then, after getting my statement, will then ask the accused, did you steal this bag? Now, if that person exercises their right to silence, and they do have a right to silence, if they execute their right to silence, what happens? It's seen as an indication of guilt. Because I've accused him, and he hasn't defended himself. Because the presumption there is, if someone accuses you of stealing, if you're innocent, you want to clear your name. You will want to defend yourself. So, if that person chooses not to say anything, he chooses to remain silent, that person then is seen as guilty, and I would reclaim possession of my bag. So, what the federal government is doing is actually moving closer towards, without even realizing it, closer towards an Islamic model right there for the presumption of guilt and innocence. So, actually moving towards that. And you'll see that, you know, again, I mentioned that the laws decreed by God are perfect. They're absolute, they're complete. They don't need to be changed. They don't need to be adjusted. They don't need to be modified. Whereas the laws of man, by a very definition, man is flawed. And so what we deem to be good now may be different to what we deem to be good in future. You know, I'm worried about things that we currently do now, and then our kids will look back and say, how could you guys do this? You know, you guys used to do such and such, and you thought it was good. You know, drawing on our culture, we look at photos of, you know, of relatives and parents and things they used to do and things they, you know, actually they used to do and through their photos and things like that, and we'll be amazed, mum and dad, how could you do this and how could you do that, and, you know, and things like that. But, you know, at the time it will seem to be acceptable. Their culture allowed it. Their culture and their values allowed it at the time. But over time, our culture and values change, and so now we view those things differently. Now, the other point which I think needs to be addressed is, if Islam doesn't change, how can it keep up with the times? If the laws in Islam do not change, how can it keep up with the times? Which is actually a very good question. First of all, the general rulings in Islam don't change. The core values. So when we talk about Sharia law, many people are actually afraid of the term Sharia law. Sharia law basically means the value system in Islam. The Islamic value system. Alright? And as we mentioned earlier, the Islamic value system is made up of, you know, respect for one's parents, the neighbours, the society in general, feeding, you know, looking after those who are less fortunate, the poor and the needy, and so on and so forth. All of these are included within Islam's value system. The issue comes in with how can we say Islam is modern when we say Islam doesn't change, and obviously society changes. What happens to Islamic law over time? Generally speaking, there isn't a need for rules to change. So the laws themselves do not change. You know, alcohol was meant to be permissible, it will always stay impermissible. It was prohibited 1400 years ago, it will stay prohibited till the end of time under the Islamic legal system. Adultery and fornication was considered to be immoral and will stay immoral till the end of time. There are certain things like murder, which is immoral, will stay immoral. So the law itself doesn't change. However, the application or the understanding of the law can be adjusted and tweaked slightly. For example, when it comes to the topic of alcohol, as I mentioned over and over, that alcohol is not permitted to be consumed in Islam. And the reason for it is very clear. The wisdoms behind it are very, very clear and numerous. You know, if you look at the social issues that happen because of alcohol, we look at domestic violence issues, we look at the road issues and accidents, till now it's the number one cause of fatalities on the road has a large part to do with alcohol consumption. So the alcohol itself is not permissible. However, what about alcohol with regards to medicinal purposes? If alcohol is as a medicinal purpose, can alcohol be used for medicinal purposes? You find sometimes you've got, you know, ointments and eye drops and things like that that have sources of alcohol or traces of alcohol in them. Can they be used? You know, some say, well, no, hang on a second. The command or the prohibition about alcohol refers to the consumption or the drinking of alcohol. Whereas if I rub ointment in my ear or on my eye, for example, that it's fine. You've got other scholars who talk about that these alcohols that are used in these sort of substances are different to the alcohol that a person consumes. You know, that don't actually cause them to be drunk and so forth, so that, you know, they're permissible to be used. So there are scholars who reinterpret certain things that to suit a modern context. So these things are possible. Another example is, for example, the legal age of marriage in Islam. What's the legal age for marriage? In Islam, the legal age for marriage is what? Puberty. So, theoretically, you could have a 12-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl getting married. Theoretically. And that would be permissible if they both reached the age of puberty. Now, some scholars these days have said, well, hang on, that we need to actually put a minimum age or a cap in terms of the legal age for marriage. The reason for that is, sure, that, you know, as we said, laws don't change. And a law at the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him, was that a person could get married as soon as they reached the age of puberty. So then how can scholars these days come in and change that ruling? Well, they're not changing the ruling, but they've said the scenario has changed. If you look at, let's say it was a 12-year-old these days, it's different to a 12-year-old, 100 years ago or 200 years ago. 12-year-olds these days, or 15-year-olds these days, you know, they're talking about Facebook, they're talking about their, you know, DS3s and their Xboxes and their PS3s and their, you know, their Facebooks and their Twitters and whatnot. Whereas if you look at, you know, a 15-year-old going back 100 years ago was talking about getting fed, was someone who had a stable job, who possibly could have had a house and a family and was responsible. So as far as I'm saying that, no, there needs to be, you know, there has to be an age of responsibility. They have to be able to, you know, have a stable job, to look after a family, to have that mental capacity, not just a physical capacity. That, yeah, when you reach puberty, you've got the physical ability, you know, to be married, such as consummating a marriage and so forth, but you don't have the mental capacity. And so some of the scholars nowadays are moving towards they're applying a minimum age in order for a person to get married. You have to have a certain mental capacity to get married, and so they're instituting that by putting a minimum age on when a person can get married. Right, so the law itself is recognized and is valid, but some scholars are reinterpreting or changing the way the law is actually applied to suit a modern context. So the law is the same, but it's being applied slightly differently to suit a modern context. So to wrap up the Islamic concept of good is that it's the answer to what is good is that good is that which has been decreed for us by God. God tells us what is good, and we follow that system and that method, and apply the rulings of God and the commands of God. And the reason that we use this is because any man-made system is prone to failure. Any man-made system is open for scrutiny and could be right or could be wrong. Whereas when it comes, anything that comes from God is undoubtedly correct, because God created us and God knows us better than we know ourselves. And so this is why the answer of, can you be good without God? Can you be a good person without God? You can be good to a certain extent, but not absolutely. You know, you can't give an absolute yes, because what you're applying, the values that you're applying may change. And so you may consider yourself to be good at the time, only to then be reevaluated by others down the track. And then they'll have a different assessment of whether or not you actually were good or not. Just as we reevaluate actions such as in the Stolen Generations or Australia's treatment of women, or we look at the civil rights movement in America, for example. Right, again, you know, those sorts of problems there, you know, were actually instituted by the government. And it was seen as, you know, this is the right thing to do. You know, the white race is superior to the black race, and this was government instituted. You couldn't have cafes and so forth where you had mixed races attending, because one race was seen as being superior to the other. And at the time, the white race considered themselves to be superior to the darker race. And at the time, they thought they were correct. They thought they were doing the right thing. And obviously, we all know how we view that now. That was a racist society. And we can all agree on that nowadays. So they applied the value system they thought was correct, only to then know that it was wrong later on. So if they were using a system that was applied by God and decreed by God, they would know that every person is created equal. And nothing sets you apart except your actions before God. So that's to sum up my response in terms of, can a person be good without God? I think we finished about 10 minutes before the end of the session. So if you have any questions, I'd open the floor for any questions that you may have, questions or comments, and happy to answer to the best of our ability if you have any questions. Thank you for reminding me. The response to the question that she asked, so just to recap, she asked me a question. She said, I'm a good person. I feed the poor. I look after the hungry and the needy, and I fight for social justice, and I do all these good things. I'm good to my family and so forth, but I don't believe in God. Why am I doomed according to the monotheistic religions? So my response to her after what seemed to be a long pause, which is about 2.5 seconds I mentioned, my response to her was, drawing on her background, I said, what do you study at university? She said, I study arts. I said, okay. So, you know, let's assume that you do an arts subject, and you've got an assignment. You give an assessment by one of your lecturers, and he says, go away and do this particular assignment. And so you walk away, and instead of doing that particular assignment, which is relevant to the subject that you're doing, instead you prepare a different assignment. You answer maybe a physics paper. You write a physics paper. And that physics paper may be absolutely amazing. It may be worthy of a Nobel Prize. It may be, you may revolutionize the entire landscape of physics. No matter how good it is, it may be a paper which, if you hand it in to a physics department, they would be absolutely blown away by it. When you hand this paper into your lecturer, what mark are you going to get? How are they going to mark it? They're going to mark it against a criteria. So the criteria is, points 1 through to 10. Have you answered this question? Have you provided this evidence? Have you done this and so on and so forth? No matter how good it is as a physics paper, you're going to get a 0 if it's marked against the criteria for your arts degree. Because you handed something in which is not relevant which is clearly, you know, clearly against what was asked of you. So in order for a person, for a person's deed to be accepted, the fundamental, or the biggest criterion, and the main criterion, is for a person to accept God. So once a person accepts God, this is the number one criterion. So we're on this earth, effectively we're going through an assessment, we're going through a test. Alright, so we need to answer all the questions and act in accordance to the marking criteria which is given to us. And that marking criteria are the commands that were given to the prophets, given to us by God, via the prophets. So that's the marking criteria that we're working against. So that was my response to the question of the time.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Podcasts on current events, Islamic guidance, Quran Tafsir, and Sira are available at IslamPodcasts.com, as well as on iTunes. Rate, review, and comment, and let us know how we can grow in our knowledge to better serve our community. Please subscribe, share, and tell a friend about IslamPodcasts.com.